Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware is making progress on improving maternal and infant health, but the work is far from done.
It's trust in the healthcare system, it's access to the care, and then understanding the care. If you have those three elements there, you're most likely to have the best outcome possible.
We chat with the chair of the Delaware Healthy Mother and Infant Consortium about the state's efforts to address maternal and infant health. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Arts Playlist previews an opera, making its world premiere in the first state thanks to Opera Delaware. And we bring you the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware has made progress in improving maternal and infant health over the past two decades, but recent data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows the state is far from finished on working to keep mothers and babies healthy. Delaware's infant mortality rate actually rose in 2022, the latest year with available data, and babies born to black mothers continue to face greater health risks compared to their white counterparts. The Delaware Healthy Mother and Infant Consortium recently held its 19th annual summit, focused on the community's role in advancing maternal and child health in the first state. And Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon caught up with Christiana Care pediatrician Dr. Priscilla Posse, chair of that consortium, to discuss what more can be done on this issue.
Broadly, what can you tell us about what maternal and infant health looks like here in the first state as we sit here today? Is it something that's in improving, getting worse? What's the outlook there?
Yeah, Kyle, it's a really important question because when we think about Delaware, we start with our families, right? And so families always, we want to make sure that our, you know, maternal health is doing well and certainly that our children are healthy, and that starts in infancy. And so you're correct. You know, Delaware has done a lot of great work around infant mortality, education around sudden infant death syndrome, education around car seat behavior. And we actually saw the rates of infant mortality decrease below the national average in 2021. And so we know that when we're doing the work, we're making strides there. Though in 2022, we did start to see a rise, and that was across all counties. And so that's in the state of Delaware. And, you know, one of the reasons we attribute that is one, you know, during the height of the COVID pandemic, it was really hard for families to get into care. And we saw that, you know, families weren't really able to access their practitioner or access the hospitals at the same level as they did, you know, pre-COVID. And so that is one of the reasons why we're starting to see an increase in the mortality rates. The other aspect is that we're getting better at collecting data. That's really what it is. We're collecting data more timely, and we're getting more information. And so that information allows us to see where the potential gaps are and how we can have the opportunities to close that gap so that Delaware once again is below the national average.
Yeah, I can see how, you know, that pandemic ripple effect and just how damaging that was. As a quick follow-up then, just as far as the scope looks like right now, as far as Delaware is concerned, you know, does it surprise you where we sit today as far as how things look? Does it fall in line with kind of, you know, more or less what you're expectations are, what you've expected to this point?
It does. You know, Delaware is a unique state in that it has three counties, and what we find is that our larger health systems, and we have a lot more of our clinical practices and resources in Newcastle County. And so what we tend to find is that the outcomes are better in Newcastle County, and as we start to travel further south, into Kent County and into Sussex County, we start to see that the outcomes are worse. So that is in line with what we expect. I really, really want to credit our Division of Public Health and our full Department of Health and Social Services that have started to intentionally direct efforts to Kent and Sussex County by enlisting practices to be in the area, by ensuring that we have more, whether it's mobile resources, more practitioners there. So that way we're starting to see improved outcomes as well.
And we know Black women and families are, you know, disproportionately emphasis on, you know, disproportionately affected in maternal and infant health. Can you walk us through that and why that is?
Yeah, so we start to see this, you know, particularly with maternal health, and that we know that when Black women, when they're pregnant, they're expecting, they are at greater risk, up to 2 to 3 times at a greater risk to face a complication in pregnancy, and at 2 times the risk to actually die from a pregnancy related complication. And so we find this particularly when we think about maternal health and then Black maternal health. You know, patients who are expecting, you know, interact with the healthcare system frequently. They go to frequent visits. Oftentimes they're getting checked out. And so it's not necessarily because the women themselves are Black. It is because that the circumstance where they are or where they live due to systemic issues over centuries now are realizing them in circumstances where they may not be able to get health insurance. We find that. They may not have transportation to get to their clinician. They may not have access to get into the practice. And so that's what we're finding with Black women as compared to other race and ethnicities, is really those social determinants of health that have been a struggle for decades are impacting them today. And so a lot of work has been done around that, educating our healthcare system. We've provided resources in the community, being intentional about working with community organizations to let people know where they can actually access care. If it's not at a large healthcare system, they can go to a small practice. They can even go to a birthing center or find a midwife. And so it's making sure that we're meeting people where they are. It's not providing everyone the same type of resource. It's really understanding what are the needs, how we can meet them where they are, and be able to provide healthcare access that's really tailored to fit their healthcare needs.
Right. Yeah. Meeting them where they are, very poignant. Well, let's unpack some of the contributing factors then. You have touched on a few of them here, but in terms of what's fueling this issue, really this, you know, what can in some people's minds be, you know, summed up to be a crisis of sorts in Delaware, at least in its own way, in the context of it all. But, you know, what are some of the bigger contributing factors here?
Yeah, you know, the first I will say actually is really being comfortable in the healthcare system. And so if you are growing up in a community or an environment where you have found that family members, generations ahead of you may not have had the same quality of care or the best care as someone in a different neighborhood, you're going to be less likely to want to go into that same system. And I think it's important, we have to actually acknowledge, right, that there is mistrust in the healthcare system across many communities, the Black community, Hispanic and Latino communities, even the elderly and veterans, you know, express concern about feeling comfortable in the healthcare system because they have seen for decades, even centuries, that those that come from those communities or who look like them or have that lived experience are treated differently, may not receive the same type of care. And so that first element is, if you're not comfortable in the system, you're not as likely to then access that system. So that's one, that's the first one. And then for those who recognize, right, that being in the healthcare system, seeing their provider, their clinician is going to give them optimal health outcomes, it's now, can I actually get there? So we have to recognize again, if you've been in a community or in an area where you don't have the same opportunity to get employment, you don't have access to the same schools, your health insurance may not be the best where you can actually go and see any practitioner. You might be limited to only going to one practice or in one area. So this now decreases your opportunity to get in for an appointment. And I would say lastly, then it's really understanding what I would call like health literacy. And so again, there are some communities, right, when I mentioned education, if you haven't been able to access formal education in the same way, you're entering into the healthcare system, information might not be presented to you in the way that you understand. That could be a language where if English may not be your preferred language or your first language, it may be the terminology that is used. It may also be how we talk about procedures. If you're not fully understanding that, then you might not be able to engage in your care in the same way as someone else. So we really say it's trust in the healthcare system, it's access to the care, and then understanding the care. If you have those three elements there, you're most likely to have the best outcome possible. When any of those things are shifted or not as quality as others, that's where we start to see negative health outcomes and the disparities start to widen between communities.
Yeah, trust, access, understanding. You can see how, you know, there's so many things that come together or have to come together. And in that same breath, so many barriers, right? So is there something you mentioned kind of the makeup of Delaware, you know, where obviously Newcastle County, you start trickling down to more rural areas and whatnot. Is there something about Delaware's general structure as a state, as far as that goes, its general makeup that makes this issue that much worse?
Yeah, if we were to drive through the state, I think anyone would recognize that when we start in Newcastle County, you know, is a location where it has, you know, the most employers, even from a healthcare system. We have more of our healthcare systems, hospitals, practices located in Newcastle County. We tend to find, you know, more schools in Newcastle County, more banks in Newcastle County. Really, there's a lot more employment opportunities. And when there's more employment, we're going to see greater population in that area. So we could call Newcastle County, right, a more urban area where we're going to see a lot more businesses that are contributing, right, to the county. Then as we start to move, you know, further south, I would say Kent, right, is we see similarities. We start to see, again, less businesses, less employment. And then as we hit into Sussex County, you mentioned it, Kyle, right? We start to see more of a rural area. And so when there's a rural area, we have more spacing between hospitals, between practices, between schools, between businesses. And what that does is it creates longer distances to get to that access. And then there are fewer resources available. And so where Sussex is such a great county, right, we see a great population, a lot of community there, right? We have the same type of community, only able to access perhaps one hospital now, or that same population only able to access two practices. So overall, what that does is it decreases availability, right? That's a numbers game. And so again, you know, I really credit, you know, our elected officials, our Delaware Division of Public Health that recognize it, they are articulating it, and now are being intentional about how do we shift resources into this area, because we know that rural, when we talk about disparities, geography and where you live also contributes to your health outcomes.
Thanks to Christiana Care pediatrician Dr. Priscilla Posse, chair of the Delaware Healthy Mother and Infant Consortium, and R. Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we head to Opera Delaware to learn more about its world premiere of Fearless by acclaimed American composer, librettist, Derek Wang. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. This month, Opera Delaware premieres a brand new musical drama, The Grand in Wilmington, created by acclaimed American composer-librettist Derek Wang. Fearless tells the true story of Hazel Ying Lee, trailblazing World War II aviator and member of the famed Women Air Force Service Pilots, and the largely overlooked sacrifices women like Hazel made. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny sits down with Wang and Opera Delaware's Vice President of Engagement, Carrie-Anne Otagno, for a preview of the world premiere of Fearless.
Let me start with you, Derek. I know this isn't your first time working with Opera Delaware. Can you talk a little bit about how this relationship came about?
So I had written an opera called Scalia Ginsburg because in addition to being a composer and a librettist, I also studied law. And that inspired me to write an opera about the Supreme Court called Scalia Ginsburg. And that opera ended up having a bit of a life and continues to get done around the country, for which I'm very grateful. And one of its earliest productions was at Opera Delaware. And Opera Delaware was terrific about it. They put it on their main stage. We did it in a new orchestration. And it turned out, as I hear, to be well received by the community here. And so, presumably based on that, we have been working together on some projects since then. For example, last season, in spring of 2024, we did a new production of the Puccini opera Turandot, depending on who you ask, for which I composed a new ending based on the sketches of Puccini, the composer, and Alfano, the completer. And continuing in that with that collaboration, now we are going to give the world premiere of this new work called Fearless. And I'm just very excited to have it happen at Opera Delaware.
And following up on that a little bit, Carrie Ann, can you reflect a little bit on the opera's work with Derek?
I knew Derek because I had seen Scalia Ginsburg several times. My husband has been in it. I knew Derek from working with him briefly at Opera Memphis when they were producing Scalia Ginsburg. And so this relationship predated, but kind of welcomed me back into my friendship with Derek, which I'm so happy about. Derek is so interesting because when people think of opera composers, I think they don't think of an Asian American lawyer. They don't think of Derek Wang, and they should, because the number one selling opera in Opera Delaware's history was Scalia Ginsburg, was Derek Wang's opera. He's a phenomenal composer and storyteller and librettist. So that means that not only he writes the music for it, but he also writes the text for it. So you get a really cohesive story from his unique perspective. And what I love about being able to present Fearless is that it's the story of this real American hero, the story of one of the first women Air Force service pilots, Hazel Ying Li. She is credited as being the first Chinese American woman to get a pilot's license and fly for the U.S. military. She was a trailblazer. She was fearless, which is what the opera is called. And it's amazing to have an opera about a real person being told by someone who is a part of that community, being told by someone who has already established themselves as such a visionary for the future of opera. Derek is a really compelling composer because his writing style is accessible and fun and melodic and lyrical and beautiful. And Hazel's story is one of resilience, and it's beautiful and amazing to be able to present that and to be able to keep coming back to this collaboration with an artist like Derek, who I really respect and appreciate.
And I wonder, Derek, could you tell me, when did you first learn about this amazing story, this amazing life?
Well, I had heard about the Women Air Force Service pilots generally through a former classmate of mine who happened to be related to one of them, but not to Hazel Ying Li. And so I had become aware of the Women Air Force Service pilots and their contributions to American history. And then a number of years ago, I came across a report or article about Hazel Ying Li. And that sort of set my imagination on fire because here was a story about a real person who had rendered great service to her country under some very challenging conditions, and also some uniquely challenging conditions in the sense that her story was very different from other pilots at the time. And her story was also different from what we today might even expect of someone of her history.
And tell me about the women's air service pilots. Who were they? What did they do?
The Women Air Force Service pilots were a group of American pilots who flew domestic missions for the United States Army, because, of course, the Air Force had not officially been established separately. And so they flew domestic missions in order to free up male pilots for combat overseas during World War II. Their duties included transporting planes that had been produced at factories. They also helped train male pilots. Despite all of this service, however, they did not become accepted at the time officially as part of the United States military. And so, despite their service, they were sort of forgotten after World War II. And it was only around the time of the bicentennial in the 1970s that they finally started to receive the recognition that they had long deserved. And then around 2010, they were honored by the president for their contributions to America.
turning to you, Carrie Ann, let's talk a little bit about the cast.
Yeah, so we have a really incredible cast for this production of Fearless. We have a couple of debuts with Opera Delaware and a couple of returning artists. In the title role, Arianna Maubach is a recent graduate of the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia, a young, super talented mezzo, and she's playing the role of Hazel Ying Lee. She recently was a national semifinalist at the Metropolitan Opera Competition. She was a winner of the Canadian Opera Competition. She is on the fast track to a major career. And to have her be a part of a world premiere like this and maybe originating this role, it could be, again, like a huge, it could be huge forward motion for this project, that to have it affiliated with an artists like Arianna who are on the rise. We also have the return of Karen Vuong, who sang Liu in Turndo last year with us. Just a deeply empathetic, beautiful singer. And this year she's playing Iris, who is Hazel's sister. Soo-chan Kim making his Opera Delaware debut. Alice Chung, she did a recital with Opera Delaware earlier this year, an artist-curated recital called Girls of Yellow Diamonds, that was about her experience as an Asian American woman. And it was beautiful and incredibly well received by our community. And now she's making her main stage debut with Opera Delaware. So it's a great opportunity to see some really special emerging talent making their debut with Opera Delaware. And it's also just a great opportunity to see some of our favorite folks like Karen returning to the stage and singing something that, again, has never existed before this moment. Like this is brand new. And so the interpretation of these artists who are making the debuts, they play a crucial role in crafting this.
I wonder as well about this opera, Fearless, premiering at this moment in history when the U.S. military is actively scrubbing information about diversity from its records. I mean, we see stories about books that reference diversity, equity, and inclusion being removed from libraries at service academies, content about women, LGBTQ plus people, and minorities being removed from military websites. And I just wonder if one of you could reflect on that and about how this music meets this moment.
I have kind of a fresh set of ears with this because we just started music rehearsals. So I got to hear the first kind of work through of it. And what I was really struck by was the personal aspect of this. I think in what we're seeing in this administration, and the expectation is less focus on the individual. And so we've gotten some pushback because the focus really is that she is an Asian American. She's a trailblazing Asian American woman who did something that no one else had done at that time. And because she did that, look at where we get to be as a society. I think it's really important that we highlight individual exceptionalism, that we highlight the stories that show people breaking barriers. I don't think that that's something to shy away from. I think that our differences make us stronger. And I think our differences are what make us really connect to people on a deep level. In this particular instance, yes, it is an Asian American story, but it's also a universal story. And the universality of it comes out of the specificity of her being wholly who she is. So I refuse to shy away from the fact that this is a story that celebrates Asian American heroes in Asian American history, because that is the history of America. That is the history of what makes our country great and special. It's because of individuals like Hazel Ying Lee.
Thanks to composer librettist Derek Wang, Opera Delaware's Vice President of Engagement Carrie Ann Ottagno, and our Mark Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. Opera Delaware's world premiere performances of Fearless are May 16th and 18th at the Grand in Wilmington. Visit the Greens page on DelawarePublic.org for more information. And we wrap up the Green next with the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. This is the Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on the Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. The podcast explores how Delawareans connect to the environments and cultures around them, and the cultural practices and creative works that bring us closer to the planet we call home. In this episode, the focus is on our own backyards, where we examine the pressures facing the delicate relationship between native plants and insects that helps build healthy ecosystems. Entomologist Doug Talamay, a professor in the University of Delaware's Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology, joins the episode to discuss the massive implications that pressures on that relationship have on things like the food web and biodiversity. Talamay is perhaps best known for his 2006 book, Bringing Nature Home, How You Can Help Sustain Wildlife with Native Plants. And he just released How Can I Help? Saving Nature with Your Yard, where he answers many of the questions he's regularly asked on this topic. So let's start to give people who are listening kind of an overview of what we're talking about. Is there a 101 explanation of what role insects play in shaping plant life and in turn entire ecosystems? I know that's a pretty broad topic, but maybe if you could kind of give us that 101 explanation so people kind of have a baseline of what we're talking about.
All right. Well, let's take Edward O. Wilson, E.O. Wilson's ideas on this. He wrote a paper in 1987 called The Little Things That Run the World. And that captures it right there. Insects are the little things that run the world, and life as we know it depends on them. And that includes our life. If they were to disappear, so would most of our flowering plants. If most of our flowering plants disappeared, that would collapse food webs that support our vertebrate animals. So we would lose our amphibians, our reptiles, our birds, and our mammals. We are mammals, I will remind you. The earth would rot because we would have lost insect decomposers that rapidly turn over nutrients. All we'd have is bacteria and fungi. So that's what he means when he says insects are the little things that run the world. They are enormously important and almost totally underappreciated. As a matter of fact, we've had a war against insects forever, and that's got to stop.
And you've spent a lot of time specifically looking at the connection between insects, native plants, and biodiversity. And as you kind of just alluded to, how it has in many ways started to break down. What do we know now about that relationship and why it matters that maybe we didn't know previously? And how is our understanding continuing to evolve?
Yeah, it gets a little bit more complicated now. But, plants, of course, are capturing energy from the sun. And through photosynthesis, they're turning it into the food that supports just about all the animals on the planet. But you have to get that food that is now in plant parts, mostly leaves, to the animals, or you don't have any animals. And if you don't have any animals, you don't have functional ecosystems. Well, it turns out that insects are the primary means by which energy is transferred from plants to other animals. And really, not just any insect. It's mostly caterpillars that are transferring more energy from plants to other animals than any other type of plant eater. So what we want to do is make sure that we have caterpillars in our landscapes. If you don't have caterpillars, you don't have birds, you don't have a lot of mammals. There's a lot of things you lose out on. So how do you do that? This is where the native plant connection comes in, because most of the insects that eat plants are what we call host plant specialists. They can only eat particular plants. And I'll use the monarch butterfly as an example. We all know monarchs are host plant specialists on milkweeds. If you don't have milkweeds, you don't have monarchs. Why can't a monarch eat something else? Because over the eons, and I'm talking about actually with monarchs, it's millions of years, they have developed the adaptations necessary to get around milkweed defenses. Milkweeds are toxic plants. And this is true for just about all the plants that are out there. They defend themselves with nasty chemicals to keep insects from eating them. So only the insects that have the adaptations that get around those chemicals, the enzymes that store and excrete and detoxify those compounds, the behavioral adaptations and life history adaptations that minimize the insect's exposure to those compounds. If you don't have those adaptations, you can't eat that particular plant. So that's why if we take milkweeds out of our yard and replace them with hostas, monarchs cannot make a living on hostas. They don't have the adaptations to deal with hostas. That locks them in to eating milkweeds. And again, 90% of the insects that are out there are host plant specialists. So if we take away the plants they have specialized on, we lose those insects. And unfortunately, the way we have landscaped over the last 100 years has done exactly that. We've thought of plants just as decorations. So we picked the prettiest plants from all over the world. And we've measured this, particularly in Delaware, about 80% of the plants in our yards are from Asia. They're from someplace else. So they're pretty, but they're very poor at supporting local food webs because our insects have not adapted to them. So we've, in doing that, we've designed landscapes that collapse the local food web.
Now, your 2006 book, Bringing Nature Home, focused on what individuals can do to help rebuild that relationship and kind of maintain or rebuild those ecosystems. And we do see that reflected now in the growing popularity of pollinator-friendly yards, native plant landscaping. Why is that grassroots level of involvement important? And how much of a difference can an individual homeowner make by just rethinking what they're doing in their own yard?
Okay, a couple of questions there. We're looking to the private landowner, the homeowner, because first of all, 78% of the entire country is privately owned. 85% east of the Mississippi is privately owned. So if we say we're only going to do conservation on public lands in parks and preserves, we're going to fail because that's not enough of the land. We need functional ecosystems everywhere, not just in parks and preserves. And we need to landscape the areas between parks and preserves so that they're not no man's land. Right now, if you're outside of a park, you know, you're in trouble in most cases. So how do we change that? Well, again, this makes the private landowner, and let's just talk about the person who lives in suburbia.
Mm-hmm.
He or she is the future of conservation because what they do on their property impacts their local ecosystem. And if we change the culture to the point where everybody recognizes that and we all do it together, then the landscapes between protected places are not no man's land. They're viable habitat. This works, and I can tell you it works because I've done it. My wife and I have done it on our own property, which was part of a farm that was broken up into 10-acre lots. And we moved in the year 2000. So it had been mowed for hay. There was just about nothing there. We've been putting the plants back over the years. And I've been measuring particularly those caterpillars that have come back and also breeding birds that are now using our property to reproduce. You know, flying by doesn't really count. You gotta reproduce there. We've recorded 62 species of birds that have bred on our property now. And I have pictures of 1,338 species of moths that are making a living on our property because we put the plants that they require back. Which means it works and everybody can do this. And I get emails every day from people who are doing it say, hey, this is great. So that's the title of the book, Bringing Nature Home. You really do bring nature into your yard in a very rewarding way. And that makes you part of the solution instead of part of the problem. One of the things that's hardest to get people to recognize is that whatever we do on our property doesn't stay on our property. You know, our properties are not like Las Vegas. You know, whatever you do in Las Vegas stays in Vegas. Whatever we do on our property ecologically impacts the local ecosystem. So either positively or negatively. If we have a giant lawn, we're polluting the local watershed. We're not supporting pollinators. We're not sequestering carbon. We're not supporting a food web. So I always talk about reducing the area of lawn. That's the most important thing we can do. But what we do at home is really important. And we've got 135 million acres of residential landscapes. It's a really good place to start.
You mentioned the things you've done on your own property. Was there something as you charted all that really stuck out to you, really surprised you about, you know, what kind of came to your property or what happened on your property?
Well, how fast all of this has happened has surprised me. Mm-hmm. How well it works surprised me. Because we had never done this before. And actually, when we moved in, I wasn't thinking about this at all. You know, I hadn't written the book yet. It was the process of moving into that property that was loaded with invasive plants. And these invasive plants are all from Asia that got me thinking along these lines. Probably the most important thing that we have come up with in my lab here at the University of Delaware is the fact that all native plants are not created equal. So it's not just native versus non-native. It's what we call contributing natives. There are just 14% of our native plants are supporting 90% of the caterpillars that are out there driving that food web. And the very best, we call them keystone plants. The very best keystone plants in Delaware and over most of the country really is one of our oaks. Oaks are supporting in the mid-Atlantic states, 557 species of caterpillars, and nothing else comes close to that. So recognizing that plant choice is really important and choosing the most powerful plants, the ones that are contributing the most energy, is what's going to make the difference. I could design a 100% native landscape that supports very little. because it's not just being native, it's being the right native that counts.
You've talked about caterpillars, butterflies. Obviously, people think a lot about bees when they think about pollinators. Are there other insects that are crucial to this kind of habitat conservation that people might overlook when they're doing native landscaping in their own backyard?
Yeah, very much. You know, the public does get it that pollinators are important, and they've gone to the other extreme. Now they think that is the only insect we need to worry about. Pollinators are important. They're you know, crucial. But insects that eat plants, they eat the leaves, have nothing to do with pollination. But they're the basis of the food web. They're really important, too, because if you don't have, and I go back to those caterpillars, if you don't have a lot of caterpillars, you don't have breeding birds. There are a lot of data on Carolina chickadees, which that is the chickadee we have here in Delaware. It takes between 6,000 and 9,000 caterpillars to get one clutch of chickadees to the point where they leave the nest. And after they leave the nest, the parents continue to feed them caterpillars another 21 days. So you're really talking about tens of thousands of caterpillars to make one bird that's a third of an ounce. And you don't want one bird. You want a population of chickadees and titmice and cardinals and blue jays and all the other things we want in our neighborhoods. Think of the number of caterpillars required to support those breeding birds. It's a tremendous number, which is why we've got to plant the plants that create those caterpillar populations. Crepe myrtle, nothing. Ginkgo, nothing. Hostas, nothing. You know, the things, privet, the things we typically landscape with are making very few or no caterpillars at all, not nearly enough to support even one family of breeding birds. So that's why plant choice on our properties becomes so important.
I also want to talk a little bit about specifically in Delaware, kind of the diversity of insects here. What insects do we see here in Delaware, native to Delaware, important to Delaware?
You know, there are 3 to 4 million insects in the world, and I think 160,000 described species in the U.S. And Delaware's got a big chunk of that. The eastern deciduous forest is a really productive place. So there are 14,000 species of moths and butterflies. How many in Delaware? Well, I told you how many I've measured on my property, 1,338 just in 10 acres. So
right.
Delaware, you know, has got many thousands of important insects. The ones that get very little attention at all are the decomposers, the ones that are breaking down nutrients. We talk about keeping the leaves on our property because the leaves from the trees, your trees on your yard, contain all the nutrients that your tree used that year. And you've got to get those nutrients back into the soil so your tree can use them again. And when we rake those leaves away, we're throwing away all those nutrients. Well, the leaves just don't break down on their own. It's insects that are breaking them down and returning the nutrients to the soil. There are more species that live in the soil than above the soil. Most of them are insects, and most of them are really tiny. So people that don't, you know, they don't pay attention at all. And this is a problem. When you get Chemlawn or some of these other companies that come and just spread insecticides on your lawn just because they say you need it, they really do it so they can charge you. You're killing all those guys. You're ending the nutrient cycle, and it's totally unnecessary. So those are really, underappreciated, critically important insects. I mean, we've talked about pollinators. We've got the honeybee. That is an introduced bee. But we have between 3,600 and 4,000 species of native bees in this country, and over 400 of them live in Delaware. If you have goldenrod and perennial sunflowers, any helianthus, and asters, native asters on your property, you can support at least 44 of those native bee species that won't be on your property if you don't have those plants. So that's called pollen specialization. A lot of our pollinators need particular plants, not just any flowering plant. So a lot of, you know, can't pick one or two that are really important. There's a lot that's important.
Are there any that are particularly threatened at this point that we should be worried about their populations here in Delaware?
All of them.
Okay.
We've got global insect decline. There was a paper out, 3 weeks ago, talking about 22% decline in North American butterflies just since the year 2000. The paper came out in 2014, a long time ago, saying that the Earth has already lost 44% of its insects, and it's not gotten any better since. So all of our insects are in decline. Look at the poor monarch. It's now red listed. Mm-hmm. I saw one monarch in my yard last year. You know, there used to be dozens. So that's an iconic insect that's in big trouble. And there's a number of reasons for that. Reasons that people don't think about. One of them is light pollution. Mm. We've got lights on all the time, most of the time for no reason at all. And they're killing insects all season long. It's a really serious environmental issue, but it's one that has a really simple solution. Take the white bulb out of your security light and put a yellow bulb in, which you can get at the hardware store. Because yellow wavelengths don't attract nocturnal insects, particularly those nocturnal moths that make the caterpillars that run our food web. So, you know, one trip to the hardware store and you have solved a huge problem nationwide. Pesticides, the misuse and overuse of pesticides. Look at the shelves of pesticides that people use at home. The only thing that's necessary is termite control, and you don't do that yourself. You hire a company who does that with baits, with very little use of pesticides. So when I talk about our war against insects, that's what I'm talking about. If we see an insect, you got to kill it. No, you don't have to kill it. It's not going to hurt you. And mosquito fogging, huge issue. The mosquito foggers say they're fogging something that's natural and organic, and it only kills mosquitoes. And if that was true, I would hire them too. But it's not true. Natural and organic, yeah, it's pyrethroids made by chrysanthemums. But cyanide is natural and organic. Ricin is natural and organic. We have lots of really toxic things that are natural and organic. And only kills mosquitoes. That's blatant false advertising. It kills all the insects it comes in contact with, including our poor monarchs, including the pollinators that you're trying to save. So the best way to control mosquitoes is in the larval stage. You can use mosquito dunks right in your own yard with a bucket. It's very easy and it works.
On the flip side, are there invasive insect species that the Delawareans should be concerned about right now that are having an impact on this ecosystem?
Unfortunately, yes. The biggest one right now is the emerald ash borer that we brought in from Asia, and it is killing our ashes. It has already killed most of our ashes. There is good news there, and that is the Beneficial Insect Research Lab here in the campus of the university has identified several species of parasitoids, that little teeny wasps that lay their eggs in the eggs of the emerald ash borer and the larvae. And they're starting to get some good control. So we had a lot of ashes around, and the beetle populations built up to huge numbers. And that wave has moved through. It's already killed most of our ashes. But now there are fewer beetles. And the young ashes that are too small for the beetle, they're still out there. And we want to encourage them because now we have parasitoids and much smaller beetle populations. And it looks like the future of the ashes is not as bleak as it used to be. But that's, you know, that's one big problem. Of course, we've had what we used to call the gypsy moth is now the spongy moth, has come through Delaware a couple of times. It's you know, rearing its ugly head in New England again. But, you know, it'll show up in Delaware again. So these are periodic things from insects that we have introduced that are problems. The spotted lanternfly. Mm-hmm. Everybody gets excited about that. That's actually resolving itself for unknown reasons. So it peaked a couple of years ago. We had spotted lanternflies everywhere, and now it's crashing. So at my house, you know, 2 years ago, everywhere. Last year, I only found two or three. Mm-hmm. So the brown marmorated stink bug, same thing. Right. We had a billion of them a couple of years ago, and now they're far fewer. So not all invasives stick around forever. But the emerald ash borer has caused a lot of trouble before it's disappeared.
We've talked about insects within kind of people's gardens and their yards. And obviously people associate them well, you know, along with forests and parks as well. But I wanted to ask you about agriculture, because our first episode in this podcast series focused on ag's history and its importance here in the First State. Where do insects fit in there with kind of the agriculture industry, and how do they impact farming in Delaware?
Well, of course, we don't like to tolerate insects in our agriculture, and entomology was founded with the idea of controlling insects in agriculture. So it was really all about killing them. And that's because the way we do our agriculture is to mass one species in one place, corn, soybeans. It's a giant resource, and any insect that can exploit that resource becomes an ag pest. So how do we manage that? There's a number of different ways. I mean, there is biocontrol. I am not saying we don't want to control insects in agriculture, but we have to be reasonable about it. And one of the unreasonable things we're doing right now is using products called neonicotinoids, which so nicotine comes from tobacco. It's really toxic to insects, and they're cheap. So we've developed, or they have developed, seed coatings. If you buy a package of corn seeds, you know, for your backyard, they're pink or they're purple. That's neonicotinoids. That's true for all of our ag crops. And the interesting thing is you plant them, and if you look at yield where there's neonicotinoid seed coatings and no neonicotinoid seed coatings, there's no increase in yield. So we're doing this for nothing. And 90% of the product washes off the seed or blows away on dust before it gets in the plant. So what we're doing is polluting all of the land and water around us with neonicotinoids, which is really toxic to our insects, without any agricultural justification. It's cheap. It's out there. That's how they're selling it. So we do it. It's already banned in Europe, but it's an issue in Delaware that we need to think about. There are some real advances about how to get biodiversity back into agriculture that I would love to see take root in Delaware. Prairie strips. That's another thing they've looked at in the Midwest. It's a wonderful solution. You put these plantings of in the east, would be eastern meadows, right in the middle of the corn and the soybeans. And not only does it provide pollinator habitat, but it intercepts nutrients, the fertilization we put on our crops before it gets into our watershed. It intercepts topsoil. And these are supported by CRP ag programs. So it's a win-win for everybody. I'd love to see all growers in Delaware adopt that as well.
How about climate change, Doug? How is that affecting insect populations here in Delaware and beyond?
We're lucky in Delaware because it's less of an issue here. In the Southwest, it's huge. In Central America, it's huge. The climate has changed to the point where what used to be cloud forests in the mountains of Central America, no longer cloud forests, and many of the insects dependent on those ecosystems are way down. Southwest, you know, we see it, the mega droughts that we're having, and of course, forest fires. No insect survives a forest fire. We got plenty of them. So climate change has not been a huge issue in Delaware.
More widely, are there certain insect species that act as kind of canaries in a coal mine when you're looking for ecological changes, the ones that people should be watching worldwide?
Oh, just a whole bunch of them. You know, we're watching the monarch. We're watching it disappear. We're watching our native bees. It was the honeybee that cued us into the fact that bees were in trouble. And then we started looking at the native bees. They're all in decline. So it really doesn't matter which group you pick, but you have to follow it over time and have good data.
You mentioned some of the things that are being done elsewhere, whether it's in the ag industry or otherwise, to do things differently. Are there some practical steps that policymakers can take to help support insect populations and rebuilding some of these ecosystems?
Absolutely. And it's happening. So, for example, Minnesota has had a cost-sharing program to help Minnesotan residents reduce or replace their lawn with appropriate Minnesota prairie plants. That helps the watershed. That helps climate change because it's sequestering carbon. Lawn is the worst plant for sequestering carbon. It helps pollinators. It helps the food web. And the state is helping people do this. California, of course, has a $3 per square foot rebate for every square foot of lawn you replace with plants that can deal with very little moisture. Pennsylvania has started a similar program to what Minnesota did. Virginia has started it. We in Delaware, Senator Stephanie Hansen's has pushed through a bill that bans the sale of invasive plants. And that needs to be done all over the country. But people hate top-down, which is why I keep talking about grassroots. You know, it's the individual homeowner. I want to empower them, help them realize that they can make a difference. They can see that difference right where they live. They can feel good about it. They can be part of the solution instead of part of the problem.
Well, I was going to say, your new book, How Can I Help, feels like an effort to help people do that. And with that in mind, what is your message to people who may want to get started but maybe feel like they don't know how, or maybe they find it kind of intimidating. What do you say to them to kind of, you know, get them past that kind of, you know, that mindset we talked about earlier, where, like, you know, when I was a kid, you know, the mindset was you want to have a beautiful manicured lawn. Now you want to kind of flip that and do something different.
No, I don't want to flip it. We're still going to have beautiful manicured lawns, but we're going to have less of them. So lawn is the perfect plant to walk on. And it's a cue for care. It shows that you understand what the culture is. You're not going to stick out in your neighborhood. You're just going to have less lawn and more plants in your yard. What I would tell to the person who gets this and says, I really want to do this, you have two choices. You can hire somebody to do it for you, because right now we hire lawn service. Most people don't garden at all. They just hire somebody. Or you can pick at it. Plant one tree this year. Make it an oak. Plant it as an acorn. It's free. Protect it from the deer. And you've done a huge thing. But don't look at it and say, oh, I got to get rid of all my lawn. I got to do all this by tomorrow. Then it becomes really intimidating and costly, and it doesn't have to be.
You've been listening to a portion of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet, with entomologist and UD professor Doug Talamy. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. And that'll do it for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for a weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, the staff at Delaware Humanities, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.